This interview has been brought to you by the Center for Action and Contemplation. The Center for Action and Contemplation seeks to empower individuals to live out their sacred soul tasks in service to the world through contemplative programs and resources. Among their programs is the Living School for Action and Contemplation, a 2-year online and on-site learning program led by faculty members Richard Rohr, Cynthia Bourgeau, and James Finley. I had the privilege of speaking with Cynthia recently to discuss her new book, The Heart of Centering Prayer, Non-Dual Christianity in Theory and Practice. Besides being a faculty member of the Living School, Cynthia is an Episcopal priest. She's an author of over 8 books and an internationally known retreat leader, traveling globally to teach and spread the recovery of the Christian contemplative and wisdom path. I sat down with Cynthia in her home turf in Maine to talk about the release of her new book, which will be out December 27th. We want to just start this conversation by talking about what prompted you to write a book about centering prayer. You already have a book about centering prayer. So what was it that prompted you to kind of dive back into this?
Well, to begin with, it's 10 years later down the pike, and a whole different world both for me personally and a whole different world for 10 more years of practice with centering prayer, 10 more years of combined insights. And what's happened for me personally in those intervening 10 years, besides 10 more years of practice under my belt, has been a deepening and emergence in what you might call the growing non-dual global awareness, or the global awareness of something that you might call non-duality. I worked for a lot of that time with a wonderful organization called Spiritual Paths, founded by Ed Bastian, to try to put together lineaged contemplative teachers from a variety of different traditions, including Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism. I was the Christian rep, to really, on the baseline of contemplative practice, really sort of talk about the traditions together in a interspiritual context. It grew out of Thomas Keating's wonderful Snowmass conferences. Mm-hmm. Ed was a graduate of this. Mm-hmm. So the whole topic of non-duality, or a further transformation of consciousness, has been very much on my radar screen for the past 10 years in that group. Part of my journey for a few years in British Columbia brought a very, very deep immersion with the gifted Sufi community in that area. And again, we begin to hear more and more talk in Christianity of transformation, heart transformation, a different way of seeing things. So these things were percolating. Then also, I think that something that's happened over these intervening 10 years is that there's been some fallout from my first book. What I really wanted to do in my first book was to emphasize the kenotic underpinnings of centering prayer. Mm-hmm. Or in other words, the heart of the practice doesn't lie in making your mind a blank, or restating in mantra-like your sacred word, or emptying yourself so that God comes. It lies in the basic practice of letting go. Letting go, as St. Paul says, although his mind was that of God, yet he did not deem equality with God something he should cling to, mm-hmm. says Paul in Philippians, he, of course, being Jesus. But rather, he emptied himself. That's the word kenosis. And assuming the state of a slave, he was born in human likeness. So the idea that what we actually are doing in centering prayer is practicing in meditation form, the letting go, the non-clinging, the moving of your mind and your attention from a state in which it's fixed on an object of thought, any object, mm-hmm. no matter how holy or pious or whatever, but fixed on an object, to another state where the attention is free, is not fixed on an object. Mm-hmm. So I could see that centering prayer was patterning this in right from the start. And the whole thing alerted me to go back and reread The Cloud of Unknowing, which I've known for a long, long time. And all of a sudden, as I was working through it, for a course I was actually asked to give, or in point of fact, for a talk I was asked to give for Contemplative Outreach of Colorado about, what is it now, about 4 years ago, that I had to go back and really start re-immersing myself in the cloud. And all of a sudden, you know, the other shoe dropped big time. That this consistent patterning in, this kenotic patterning in centering prayer, that we do thought by thought by thought by thought, letting go by letting go by letting go by letting go, was exactly what the author of The Cloud is talking about when he says that any object of thought is between you and your God. I saw that what he's really talking about is a whole different kind of attention, which is not running in a subject-object configuration, but is really gathered in itself. I love the phrase from Rumi, quivering like a bead of mercury. So it holds a kind of tensile strength of a field of diffuse awareness. And I said, centering prayer is patterning this into people right from the start. It's known in the other spiritual traditions. I knew that because of all the work in the interspiritual band for the past 3 or 4 years. It's programmed in. The Buddhists talk about it as Rigpa, or objectless awareness. But it's assumed to be a very high state that can only be accessed after years and years of practice in concentrative meditation. So I saw that what centering prayer was doing was really giving us, right from the get-go, practice in patterning the attention so it could let go of objects and hold itself in this diffuse, objectless awareness. And then once I saw that, and once I saw that that's what the cloud of unknowing has been talking about, I began to ask the question, well, does centering prayer, does this practice of patiently letting go and letting go and letting go and letting go of thoughts pattern in a physiological predisposition to be able to hold the attention in that way? And I could see that this was so. I could see it first in my own practice. I could see it, first of all, in the very intriguing but not quite rigorous results coming from the Heart Math Institute that draw a correlation between not getting constricted around an object or any kind of holding on and the capacity of the heart and brain to attend. And I saw it finally in some neurological research that I was a party to investigate, but that centering prayer really seemed to be patterning in, both attitudinally and physiologically, an increasing capacity for what the Christian East called putting the mind in the heart, which is not just a kind of emotional description, but a very precise physiological description of what's required neurologically to run the program of non-dual awareness, which doesn't split the viewing field into subject and object in order to perceive it. So it was really a matter of connecting the dots. And when the dots all connected, it was pretty clear that I needed to write this book.
Yeah, the correlation that you're making between not splitting the field, objectless awareness, and the way that you're also connecting what is spiritual with the physiological component.
Yeah.
I think is really fascinating, because we tend to think of prayer almost like a mental thing that we do. And I find that so many people who talk about feeling stuck in their centering prayer practice, or that this just doesn't work for me, describe a very mental sort of process.
And exactly.
Maybe this is the missing link.
Exactly. I think that's so, that the way it was really originally presented, and of course the way it was understood and received, given the 2,000-year track record of the Western psyche, is that the idea was that you use your sacred word. Your sacred word stands for everything you would say for God in millions and millions of words, but it's the little dense pack of it. And you spend the time wondering, well, is this a thought? Is this a thought? Is this a thought? Do I have to use my sacred word? And is this the right sacred word? Is this really my... So you see, in a way, it's all about the mind. It's all about thinking. It's all about, do I get it right? And in general, in Christianity, there's almost no awareness that prayer takes place in the body.
Yeah.
And that there's long, long theological discourses about the meaning of it. You know, you can find reams and reams, volumes written on kenosis as a theological act. But there's not a single word that I've ever seen written that describe it as a physiological act.
Yeah.
As a way, what happens in your body when you let go? These questions don't even compute in the Christian radar screen. So you get people all tangled up in their heads, trying to use a whole bunch of different techniques to make themselves quiet so God can come, which is just an idea anyway. Whereas what the Eastern tradition has been telling us all along, the Eastern Orthodox, I mean, is that putting the mind in the heart, collecting the energy of attention in a different configuration and at a greater level of intensity makes possible a pathway of perception that doesn't require the field to be divided into subject and object in order to make sense. It's sort of like when you were a young singer and somebody said, we're going to sing around. Let's sing, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. And then when the next part came in, you put your hands in your ears so they didn't pull you off course.
Right.
But once you've become trained in music, you've learned that the other part doesn't, far from pulling you off course, it actually helps you because it exists in the same harmonic bandwidth. So it helps you to know where you are. And you're able to perceive, rather than three separate lines fighting with each other, one single event which is happening vertically in time. And it's the same sort of way with shifting from head perception to heart perception. Head perception is linear. It separates in order to hold on to its little thing that it has. This greater non-dual diffuse awareness perception can take in the whole picture by not having to focus on or focus out a single part.
So then the practice of prayer ceases to be about attaining some state and rather encouraging this muscle, this way of perceiving from the whole, and encouraging the growth and the strengthening of this muscle to let go so that we can perceive from the whole. And that seems to be a process of becoming interiorly undivided so that we can then kind of see from that undivided state.
I think that's true, and I never know whether or not to trust the kind of funky reports I get from my friends in the science world when I'm leading a religious workshop, but somebody pointed out to me that in embryology, in fetal development, the heart and the brain are a single unit for some really amazingly long time into the gestation period, and then they finally split apart like maybe Africa and South America. But you can see the imprint of the one on the other as if they were intended to be in close reciprocal dialogue. It's almost like a human being is anatomically made for this. But we've come to lose the emphasis of that. We've associated the brain with mental idea of ourself as the seat of our identity. We've associated the heart with just emotionality and sentimentality, affectivity, rather than the seat of clear, undivided perception, which is what it was seen to be originally in the transformational traditions of the Christian East. And so we've created a fundamental divide where our tradition has been telling us that it's only when we complete the fundamental reunification of putting the mind in the heart, putting the brain in the heart, not just attitudinally, but in terms of really creating a neurological, physiological re-entrainment of the two, only then does it become energetically possible to run the program that allows undivided perception. When the energy field is too scattered, too uncollected, as they spoke about this in the Eastern Orthodox writings, then by default, you fall back into the only program that you can run, which is middle egoic divide and conquer, separate to see. And it's the kind of program that the West has been running for 2,500 years, and that most of its theology and nearly all of its devotion has been written out of. So it's only the kind of crazy mystics that model for us what undivided perception feels like. So, of course, people then say, well, they're just crazy, they're not rational. Well, they certainly are rational, they're transrational. But anyway, what I saw was that centering prayer artlessly and innocently, without any real realization that this is what it was doing, was laying the physiological groundwork for a developed capacity of non-dual awareness. So the heart has always been seen in the Western tradition as central to the physiological underpinnings of non-dual consciousness and non-dual selfhood. And that's an emphasis that has fallen out in some of the comparative typologies. The West would say that you can't just do the tiers of consciousness the way Ken Wilber stacks them up, that it's not a straight line progression from second tier, from pluralistic and integral into the non-dual, that something has to happen, that the mind has to physically drop, become re-entrained with the heart, so that a whole different operating system of perception becomes stabilized. And then you enter third tier.
Yeah. You, in a lot of your work, you talk about three-centered awareness and the roles that mind, heart, and body play. And it strikes me that the body is part of this third force that moves the mind into the heart, that creates some of this entrainment. You know, you're describing prayer as an exercise, a muscle, an actual muscle, not just an idea of a muscle, but that this is somehow patterning an interior muscle within us so that we can become entrained. You know, I wonder if you would just talk about
that. Yeah, I think that's so. And I owe it to my dear brother Eckhart Tolle, who has this wonderful little discourse on the body and in the power of now. And he says, you know, we've been taught in spirituality to disregard the body. But hey, look, folks, nobody gets enlightened outside of the body. that Buddha is sitting there under a bow tree, but he's in his body.
Yeah.
He doesn't get dematerialized. And so many of our axial spiritualities have directed us to despise the body, to see it as the enemy, to see it as the negative weight that keeps pulling us down into the gross and corrupted world, and to equate spirituality with dematerialization. And this is simply unhealthy. And it really is a bizarre and curious twist in a religion whose centerpiece is supposed to be incarnation.
Exactly.
I.e. Christianity, that God so loved the world that he gave his son in full embodiment. Mm-hmm. So we very, very quickly in our Christian self-articulation as a religious pathway went back and relied on the Platonic concepts of the Greek noetic world to move away from the deeply lusty, robust, incarnational thrust of the message that had come to us originally. So a lot of the work in 21st century spirituality is a reclaiming of our birthright in incarnation, an unpacking of what that means. My sense is that centering prayer, once you really get it, that its core function, its core practice, the kenotic release, is a subtly embodied gesture, not an attitude. It's something that actually happens when your mind lets go of the subject-object configuration of attention, that there's a whole slight little etheric trembling and readjusting through the body that means something else is happening. And over the course of time, that letting go and letting go, that letting go, that patterning in, that the first thing you do when you're faced with any situation in life is not to brace and tighten and constrict and clinch, but to let go. Mm-hmm. Because centering prayer has already taught you that as the pathway to prayer, begins to affect the whole physiology of your presence. And as that happens, then the quality of your attitude shifts, and you build yourself a little nest deep within your chest where a different sense of selfhood can begin to arise, one that doesn't need the identification, the qualifications, I'm me because I have all these unique features that are not you. but can run a much more unboundaried and in that sense transparent sense of presence without feeling threat, without feeling a need to close down. So I could see that centering prayer was programming into people the physiological predisposition for non-dual awareness. But we were still tying our understanding of it to a really dualistic, psychological and even pop-psychological understanding of the human person and of what's transforming and what's getting healed. So it's like driving a jet airplane up and down the runway.
Yeah.
You know, we were never letting it take off because the major thing it was seen to be in service of was the healing of the false self, mm-hmm. with the implication that once the false self was healed, then your true self was your healed ego, which just nails its feet to the ground and I think has been the other major thing that's been a factor in the stuckness in some quarters of centering prayer teaching over mm-hmm. 20 years. We just haven't realized that it's intrinsically a non-dual practice, heading people towards non-dual selfhood. So the purpose of my book was really to try and reframe centering prayer from this non-dual perspective.
Yeah, and the somatic element.
And
of
the
that.
Somatic, yeah.
Which I'm so grateful that you did. You know, I think my own experience with centering prayer, which is brief, but I, over the years, began to locate this action of letting go in my body, which really surprised me. So I didn't know if I was doing this right or not. But for me, this location, it had something to do with my breath. It had mm-hmm. kind of in my solar plexus, the mm-hmm. spot would kind of tighten up whenever I was, you know, stuck on a thought, on mm-hmm. an object, and that sort of subject-object polarity. And that when I would release, interestingly enough, it was a muscle in my body that mm-hmm. would relax.
Yeah.
And that relaxed state of being not only allowed me to let go of that stuckness, but also to breathe deeply and kind of be present in a completely different way. So the practice took itself off the cushion and became a mode of being. And I think in your book, you name this process of this is a somatic experience and how this is actually living itself out in our bodies is part of how we take this forward.
Exactly. I will often in my own introductory workshops on centering prayer actually start people by practicing the gesture of relief and release in a big external way by having them clench their hands and then unclench them and then clench and unclench while breathing. So they begin to become aware of the difference in state of their being when they're in a clenched position and when they're in an unclenched position. And from there, it becomes simple to move it more interiorly and to suggest to them that when their attention is grabbing onto an object of thought, no matter how holy or wise or wonderful a message, it's in essentially a clenched position.
Mm-hmm.
And that the releasing of that thought in the spirit of kenosis or letting go has exactly the same effect, though in a much smaller way, you know, mm-hmm. in the micro physiology of our body. You could say that we're really talking in one way about physical model, physical muscles,
mm-hmm.
but at that level, which is energetic, mm-hmm. some people call it the auric level or the etheric level, it's really profound aerobics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the vibrational level for tuning up the body, for tuning up the being. I thought, for me, one of the most important pieces of wisdom that ever generated itself in the Centering Prayer network never really made it onto the introductory workshops, which was the story of the nun who tried Centering Prayer for the first time in an introductory workshop decades ago,
mm-hmm.
taught by St. Thomas Keating himself, and she tried it, and she says, I'm going to be such a failure at this prayer, and in 20 minutes I've had 10,000 thoughts. How lovely, says Thomas, not missing a beat. 10,000 opportunities to return to God. And that, for me, is mighty. It's the sense that you know, most people try to think that what you have to do in centering prayer is to make your mind quiet, and then God can come.
Right.
But what really happens is that every time we release a thought, as a process, even though 1,000 more can come back right back in, that we're practicing and strengthening this subtle muscle of release, which is physically embodied somewhere around the solar plexus. And that this does, over time, create a whole different predisposition within us. It rewires. It also gives us something that we can directly carry over into life, as you've observed, so that it narrows the gap between the cushion and daily life. So when you sit down in the cushion, you're merely concentrating what you're doing all day in life anyway. And when you go back out and do it in life, it is with the direct connection that this is simply the core motion of the prayer carried over into action.
So our bodies essentially are, in some ways, praying without ceasing.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a really wonderful day to do that. You can't be silent without ceasing, but you can consent without ceasing. If that consent, of course, being the term that the centering prayer movement likes to use for kenosis, for the letting go, for the being willing to release.
To trust.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word attitude a little bit ago, and coming from the ballet world, that word carries a double meaning. You know, it's not just your attitude in terms of your emotions or your feelings. Your attitude is a physical posture. And so that's an interesting way to kind of think about centering prayer as an attitude. It's this ongoing internal.
That's very lovely. I hadn't known that. And of course, you were a ballerina. So what is an attitude in ballet?
It's a posture.
Can you take an attitude with a bad attitude and it'll look and it will look like
you
a bad
sure
attitude?
Can. You sure can.
So that's wonderful because I think it brings the emphasis right where it ought to be. On our bearing in the world, our carriage, and that so much of what goes on and creates heartbreak and anguish and discord, particularly at that pluralistic level of consciousness, is our belief that all change has to be carried by our words. And so much of change is carried by our attitude, by how we bear ourselves in the world, that a person who's deeply calm and in tune can walk into a room and say nothing, and the room will change. And we haven't learned to trust this yet because it doesn't really factor in our mental categories. But I think there's a whole rich world of embodiment that centering prayer has actually been opening people to, that we don't have a theology to match yet. And I think we need to create it, download it, you know, develop it, certainly in the 21st century, because the age of disembodiment is over. Done.
Yeah, it's time to live out this incarnational promise we keep talking about.
Yeah, you heard there's a line in some sort of history of science book somewhere that someone was asking people about how do scientific paradigms shift from one to another, how do you convert people from like the pre-Einsteinian to the Einsteinian, and this wonderful commentator on the history of science says you never convert people. You know, the old generation dies out. And I feel that so keenly right where I am, that our generation, our boomer generation, just really seems stuck in thinking about things a certain way. And so far you can go, but no further. But the new generations emerging think from a completely different place. And it's a much more embodied place. And I think myself a lot of the continuity of the lineage of centering prayer and these great breakthroughs that we've made in the last 40 years of the 20th century towards contemplative reawakening really are going to crucially depend for their long-term stability on going back and rethinking the whole language of embodiment and disembodiment and plugging it into a new base of realized interior experience that we haven't been talking out of up till nowadays.
Yeah, and I think it's part of what causes us to sort of differentiate between, you know, action is in one camp, contemplation is in another.
Exactly.
The monastics abandoned the world. They didn't want to act in it. When really what was happening, it seems, is a desire to follow the Ihidaya, the desire to live out the premise of becoming undivided.
Exactly.
So that they could then serve the world from a different posture, a different bearing.
Exactly. And it's so, so much a typical, almost iconic of the past 2,000 axial years that that the phrase Ihidaya, or the single one, or Eremos, got translated so quickly in the tradition as single in the sense of unmarried and celibate.
Disembodied, what a
disembodied,
surprise.
Disembodied, right, rather than what it clearly means in its context clues in the early tradition, which is unified in the sense that we nowadays call enlightened or realized, self-realized. Mm. And so the implication was going to be the only way you could be self-realized was if you were celibate, if you were not married, if you were out of the world, if you were sitting on a pole for 40 years. And we're done with that. What we're realizing is that this next level of consciousness, whatever it is, takes place in the world and in the midst of embodiment. And it has to do with maintaining a different interior attitude, and we'll use that word in both senses, toward the actual your quality of presence in the now. And that centering prayer understood in that way is tremendously useful for helping to pattern in and stabilize a different quality of presence. Mm. But that's progressively so to the extent that we're able to really embrace it as a non-dual practice rather than as a therapeutic practice for the ego.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the cloud of unknowing. And that was an early inspiration for centering prayer. I wonder if you would just talk about that and then your own interest in the cloud of unknowing.
Sure. Well, the cloud of unknowing is a 14th century British spiritual classic written by an unknown author who is assumed to be a monk, probably Carthusian, is generally assumed to be a male. It's not absolutely cast in stone, but I think from the quality of the language and the imagery that's used in the text, it's probably male. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because aside from being a very interesting spiritual classic, it's also one of the first pieces of work written in vernacular English in the 14th century, the same era as Chaucer was writing the Canterbury Tales. Mm-hmm. So it's a profound treatise. It's an artifact in the history of English literary history, which is where I first encountered it as a graduate student in medieval studies back in the late 1960s. Of course, I had no idea what the text was saying, but I loved the Middle English, and I still love the Middle English. Anyway, the book, in many very bad translations, has been cherished in the monastic classic contemplative tradition for 6 centuries now. Mm. And it's generally classified as a classic in the school of Christian love mysticism, on the strength of one of the lines in the text, which says, God may be touched and held close by love, but by thought, never. And so people say, oh, what it's doing is it's really encouraging transformation through love. Love, of course, understood to be affection, zeal, desire. Mm-hmm. And I went back and looked at it. People who work in centering prayer become, whether they like it or not, bedfellows with the cloud of unknowing, because it was the cloud of unknowing that prompted the original spark of inspiration for the practice of centering prayer. When Father Thomas Keating challenged his monks back in the late 1970s, is it not possible to put the whole of the Christian contemplative tradition in a single meditation practice that could be used by contemporary people in the world, one of the monks, Father William Menninger, went back to the cloud of unknowing and found right there in chapter 7 the paragraph that became essentially the core of the message, method of centering prayer. So centering prayer is joined at the hip to the cloud of unknowing. And that's very, very interesting, because now that we have at least 40 years of people who've been working at centering prayer in some form or another, we also have a 20-year or 40-year empirical database of people who've actually been transforming their life more or less according to the cloud of unknowing. So I thought that was really interesting. But when I went back to reread the cloud, and what really prompted me to that was I was starting to read some of the translations in that most people encounter the cloud in and said, huh? That doesn't make sense. That can't be right. So I went and I looked, and still lurking on my shelf was my old English edition of The Cloud of Unknowing from 1968 when I first studied it in the graduate school. And I pulled it out and I looked at the discrepancy between the translations and what the text is actually saying. And I said, oh my God, are we reading the same book? Are we living in the same universe? And that the most popular translations at that point were translating through a heavy theological filter that basically didn't exist in the 14th century. They were willy-nilly changing whole concepts and rewriting whole sentences when they didn't understand what was being suggested here. So when I went back and took the original edition, I could see more and more clearly that what the author was really talking about was contemplation, first of all, is a work, not a state. It's not this lofty state of being, but as a practice that you do in order to bridge a transition between two places. And it was very clear that the transition was between rationalistic, middleistic subject-object thinking and this incipient, non-dual, holographic awareness. And that over and over again, these comments that had been mistranslated, when they were translated correctly, clearly see that the gist of his message lies in the fact that he's trying to teach people how to withdraw their attention from objects. And he's trying to say that if you really want to be a contemplative, the work, you know, the power doesn't lie in the attractiveness, or the criteria is not the attractiveness of the object, but the configuration of your attention.
Yeah, that's profound, because I've really struggled with, you know, when I first read The Cloud, for me, it was this experience of, oh, I just have to pierce this cloud of unknowing. I just have to push through. And that my longing was this desire that was going to pierce through the cloud and reach God. But I was still making God the object.
The object out there
that I was seeking to try to like get to.
Yeah.
And has been somewhat my issue with a lot of the nuptial mystics and the, you know, the love mystics, because it still felt like, man, we're still splitting the field. It's still the subject-object, and you're still trying to reach somebody out there.
Yeah. I think that what the cloud of unknowing really is a 14th century forerunner in the phenomenology of consciousness. And if you can imagine how way out ahead of his times he was, we didn't have Ken Wilber yet, we didn't have maps of levels of consciousness. And what he was trying to stammer his way to saying is that there is a way of paying attention that doesn't put your attention out on an object. When he says that any object of thought, any thought, is between you and your God. I mean, it gets in the way. And this wonderful image he uses in the fifth chapter that's always mistranslated, he says that the thought becomes for you, for the moment that you're having it, like a target for an archer. And the archer's attention is fixed on it. Mm-hmm. And the whole of the attention is absorbed in the object. That's wild. And so for most of us, you know, the hardest point in centering prayer is Thomas's teaching that, you know, if the Blessed Virgin herself should come up to you during the prayer time and offer to take away a wound from your side, the answer is, not now, dearie, I'm doing my centering prayer. And ouch, because we're trained in our Western tradition to use silence to listen to messages. Mm-hmm. And God out there uses the medium of silence to tell us something that's of value to our little universe. And you have to realize that none of that is true. That's all running around in the hamster cage of dualized perception. And the author of The Cloud of Unknowing understood that. And he understood that if you could learn to let go of objects, no matter how worthy, and stop evaluating on the basis of external worthiness, that you had the chance of holding your attention in a different way that allowed God to stop being another great concept out there, but the enfolding field of everything.
Yeah, that's a huge shift.
It is.
Because we still have, you know, what do we do with our longing? You know, we throw it out like the archer. We, you know, we point it in a direction. Mm-hmm. And so we are somewhat trained to think of God as the new direction that we're going to, you know, just send all of our yearning out to. And it becomes, you know, another search for an experience or a connecting point, you know, whether we're waiting for a message or an experience, that is still turning God into an object. It's still splitting the field.
Exactly. And the yearning is used as the trajectory of the arrow to hit the target.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that the yearning is the cloud myself. I think the yearning defines, circumscribes the field in which the direct encounter heart to heart with divine yearning and human yearning meets, touches, and interpenetrates. And that we have to learn to hold the field undivided between subject and object, so that the yearning can become the field of communion rather than the arrow we ride straight into the heart of some object out there. But it takes a very strong nervous system to do that, because as you've no doubt noticed, yearning is a very, very powerful vibrational energy. You feel like it can just rack you right apart, like it can tear your being in two. It doesn't have to. But it takes a very, very strong, physically, neurologically grounded nervous system to be able to allow the energy of yearning to run through your being and connect you to the all rather than destroying you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of my favorite lines in the book where you say, true love is the capacity to bear infinite yearning.
Yep.
I mean, you know, that there's something about yearning that is essentially the fabric of the cosmos itself, that yearning and longing is part of that love structure of reality.
Exactly. And you just have to, you know, as one of my Sufi masters says, you know, spiritual practice is about strengthening the nervous system so that we can bear the beams of love, said William Blake. And that's the real work of spiritual practice. Won't happen apart from embodiment. There's no way you can bear yearning in the mind alone.
So centering prayer becomes an opportunity to embody this practice of letting go and being able to bear that tension.
Bear the tension without it becoming destructive of your being. Mm. Like the Cloud of Unknowing says, it's talking about Mary Magdalene. Well, it's the thing with all yearners, the more you love, the more you long to love. So the capacity to bear, to be the infinite capaciousness of divine love. Teilhard de Chardin talks at one point about the boundaried infinite, you know, that you're out there in the unfathomable, and yet somehow it's profoundly contained.
You mentioned Mary Magdalene, and I loved the section on Mary Magdalene in the book, surprise, surprise, but I wonder if you would just kind of talk a little bit about how the cloud presents her in a kind of new, different light.
Well, the cloud pulls her right out as the model for all contemplatives, but in a very interesting way. And he does it, casually, I would say, that he's talking about the Virgin Mary for a while, and all of a sudden around chapter 15 you get the sudden switch track and we're talking about Mary Magdalene. And he's working with the old school Mary Magdalene, the 14th century, you know, recovering prostitute, whore, you know, all the old stereotypes that we're only now setting aside. But he's working them in an absolutely brilliant way, and he minces no words that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had a very special relationship. Great was her love for him, says the cloud, but greater was his for her. And the cloud doesn't go at that by just saying because he was God and he loves everybody. He says because he wouldn't let anybody put her down or shame her. And he talks about how when Simon the leper talked against her at the banquet, Jesus came to her defense. So it's not because he loves her in this universal sort of chivalrous way, but because he loves her. He stands up for her as his champion, as his intimate. So the author of The Cloud simply doesn't mince words, that there is something between them that has a strong basis in eros and yearning and desiring. But then what he does is he looks at her and says, well, what transforms her and why she's appropriately the model of contemplative life is not because she repented her sins, but because she loved much. So already that's wild enough. That's where the more you love, the more you long to love phrase comes in. But then he goes on to qualify, well, what kind of love is this? And this is where, for my money, the cloud of unknowing just leaves behind all pretension of being captured as a love mysticism text. Because the author makes clear, she hung up her longing, her love and her longing desire, it says, in a cloud of unknowing, and learned to love a thing that she could never see clearly in light, either by the light of her reason or by the power of her affection. So this love that he's talking about is not obviously emotion. It's not just the yearning that you feel and you desire someone so intensely that you think you're going to break into bits if you can't have this person. It's bearing that infinite yearning, which is God's yearning finally to reveal, to self-disclose, for God's yearning for intimacy, which permeates and haunts the whole cosmos, and only the strong can bear it. So her love is really a deeply apophatic, contemplative love that is not exhausted in an object, but travels through that object right into the depth of the yearning, which is bottomless.
So then we learn how to live from this place of objectless awareness as a call to that, to bearing that infinite yearning.
Yeah, exactly. And to bearing, another way of looking at that is sharing in the suffering of Christ, because that's the infinite yearning that's incarnate in him as well. And so we learn not to numb out our yearning. You know, so much of monastic tradition of another era just taught us, you know, this force is so powerful that the only thing you can do is numb it down or it's going to destroy you. But what you learn to do through this transpersonal or non-object related new way of being at the non-dual level is not to put it on an object. It's, you know, when people used to say in the shorthand of this to me, well, you don't really want this person, you only want God. I'd say, hell no, I know what I want. But of course, you know, they were making God an object to be competing with another human object, which is the trap in all of it. When in reality, God can never be the object of love, but only the subject of love. And that we have to realize that our loves for human people are true and excruciatingly particular, and to honor them for that. But to realize that love is by nature an infinite yearning, and therefore it can never be completely satiated, can never be absorbed in another person. You never want to get to a place where you're so filled that you don't yearn anymore. That the more you just, your draw drops at the yearning, at your love of this person, and you realize even if you're in a relationship which in which all kinds of self-disclosure and sharing of intimacy are permitted, even there, you can't touch that final part of it. It finally just reduces to the infinite yearning, and you just are standing there facing that directly. So that all human beings and all human love become, I would say, icons of the divine love. Windows and doors that allow us in the most fragile touchdown form to taste the excruciating particularity and yet the boundless vastness of the infinite yearning.
Yeah, this sounds very painful. This sounds like a path of a lot of pain. So in the embodiment of this, I wonder if understanding that love is this transformative, generative power. You know, we have a tendency to think about love as, like you just described, it as a completion and sort of a satiation.
Mm-hmm.
But poets like Rilke describe love as something different, to become a world mm-hmm. unto yourself so that you can be a world to somebody else. And that describes that tension between the self and the other. It describes a tension of almost objectless awareness, you know, yeah. of not turning the other into, you know, your object.
Yeah, well, wasn't it Rilke that said that beauty is only the beginning of a terror we can just scarcely bear? Or is it the other? I mean, it works the other way. Terror is just the beginning. I was privileged to have this trip to the Vatican. I got to see for the first time face-to-face the Pietà. And I have to say that nothing could prepare me for the look on Mary's face. I'd seen it in the art catalogs, but you just can't see it. There's this woman who in physical age is young, you know, she looks like a woman in her 30s or early 40s. And what is there on her face is such true resignation. There's beauty, there's serenity, there's deep depth of heart broken, ashes to ashes, but no drama. Just complete quiet containment of the ravaging fires of love. Without blame, without guilt, without being destroyed, she sits there hove to, as we'd say in nautical language, just hunkered down amidst the storms of passion and the decimation of dreams and desires. And there she sits, beautiful and serene and tempered and ageless. And for me, that's practice. That just made me gasp. I couldn't, my daughter was asking me, well, what words would you use to describe this? And I couldn't find them because the contexts are all wrong. When you talk about resignation in the English language, it sounds like giving up.
Yeah.
You know, and this is really what Jacob Burma would call in German, Gelassenheit, that fierce repose and equanimity that lies on the other side of everything being destroyed. And I think that it's out of that quality that the redemption of the world happens. And so the path of learning to bear part of that, I've never agreed, I've never been interested in spiritual practice that says that the goal is to be happy. You know, and I realize that kind of is a reductionism, a Western reductionism of what the Buddhist models say when they speak about being happy. They're speaking about something much closer to what I was just describing. Mm. But nonetheless, it's often interpreted in spiritual practice that the goal is to use your practice so that you don't have any sadness, so you don't have any suffering, so you don't have any pain, so mm-hmm. that your life is blissfully, delightfully, as Gurdjieff used to call it. And know that the real work is to so clarify and deepen the capaciousness of your own heart that you can bear a bit of that divine yearning that things have to be the way they are in order for anything to be. This close and no closer can you come? Because the moment you step one step over that line, you've destroyed the thing you love. How can the sun touch a snowflake? You know, and it takes great heart and it takes great inner stamina to be able to bear that consciously without being destroyed by it.
It sounds like you're describing intimacy, true intimacy.
You know, yeah.
That it becomes a field that we can perceive at all times, this intimacy, this vastness and imminent, you know, at the same time, the terrifying and then the incredibly tender.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, and Robert Sardello really pointed this out to me, is that that whole thing is there already loaded into us in the natural field of our heart. And when you are able to turn inward to your heart, physiologically, not emotionally or visually, but to actually sense your way into what is the actual vibration, what is the actual emotional color of the heart field, it's astonishingly tender and intimate. And it kind of throws you off guard because you think that tenderness and intimacy are own things that can only happen in a relationship. And as a matter of fact, many of us spend half our lives searching for relationships so that we can express these great qualities. They're already. Like Dorothy with her shoes in The Wizard of Oz, you know, spending her time frantically looking for how to get home, and it's on her feet. So the capacity is already there. The real challenge is that part of our vocation, part of our post, as being embodied, incarnate bits of consciousness in this planet, is to live it out in physical time space, in finite relationships, in finite ventures, so that the thing begins to take on flesh.
So I think there's so many things coming together for me with this book. You know, it's the practice of centering prayer as interiorizing at a somatic level this gesture of letting go, the yearning, the hot coal of yearning in the cloud of unknowing, and understanding God as the cloud, this objectless awareness itself, that capacity to live in that non-dual state.
Yeah.
And I mean, I mentioned that Rilke describing becoming a whole world for a whole world, you know, we become a whole world. Maybe this is the incarnational premise, is that we cannot offer the world what it needs if we ourselves are still clinging and grasping and splitting the field into subject and object. But the capacity to pattern ourselves in this way gives us access to that intimacy of God at all times, in everything.
Exactly.
So that we can then live out of this generative place.
Exactly. The generative, the abundance, the fullness, the whether I die, I am the Lord's. That rather than the scarcity and the clinging and the sense that yourself is nothing but this sort of isolated bit of consciousness adrift in the planet, you get to touch what Teilhard calls that underlying unity that holds all the bits together without invalidating or murkying up their bitness, their particularity, but still allowing each one of us to take confidence and abundance and bearing in the fact that we belong to a universal field of love to which we have 100% access at all moments.
It reminds me of the quote that you have of how you describe hope as a place that we live from.
Yeah, exactly.
Not as a, you know, end result.
Exactly. Because you see, the phenomenal self, even the high-functioning ego, is always going to remain chronically anxious because the whole egoic principle is derived from ego, from that middle rational perception, which divides the field in order to perceive it. So I always experience myself as scarce and contingent, as waning, as being threatened by the outside, as being weak, as being disconnected. And I get the agenda that I have to fight and claw and cling to what's mine. And that kind of message is crazy making, you know, is really. And when you move from neurotic functioning into high egoic functioning, at least you can tend to not trip yourself over your own feet so much. But the fundamental premise doesn't shift. And so what happens when you move into that witnessing presence, which is made possible when the mind enters the heart, is that that sense of a threat, of scarcity, drops out, and you simply move. And you simply live with much, much less need to take on a violent or urgent or acquisitive relationship to reality, or an oppositional one. Buddhists have been saying that all along. But it's right there in Christian non-duality as well, if we could only get to it.
Cynthia Bourgeau's new book, The Heart of Centering Prayer, Non-Dual Christianity in Theory and Practice is out December 27th, but you can pre-order your copy today. To learn more about the Center for Action and Contemplation, be sure to visit our website, cac.org.